From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. U.S. soldiers are sleeping in more Baghdad palaces tonight, but 40 weeks in the ruined opulence of Saddam Hussein's gilded villas may be the closest many American troops ever get to living the high life. America's soldiers, the young men and women winning this war, are not the sons of America's affluent elite. Tonight on Point, a profile of America's military today. Who's in, who's not, and why it matters. We begin with developments in northern Iraq while the battle for Baghdad goes on. American special forces and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters are pushing closer to the key northern cities of Mosul and the oil center Kirkuk. Michael Goldfarb, senior correspondent for WBUR's Inside Out documentary unit, has been traveling in northern Iraq near the moving battlefront. I asked him what he's seen.
Today, Tom, I left Erbil, which is where I've been based, and drove about 4 hours to Duhok, which is in the northwestern part of Kurdistan. I hung a left turn and came back the direction that I started out in, and about got to the front, which is 15 miles north of Mosul, which is one of the two key cities up here, the other being the oil city of Kirkuk. Mosul is the big population center. The front has pushed forward quite dramatically over the last 48 hours.
So what's going on? Are U.S. and Kurdish forces pushing hard, or are the Iraqi forces simply giving way? What's it look like there, Michael?
This is the big difference. Down here in Erbil, it's been very much about the Iraqi soldiers simply leaving empty territory, and special forces and Kurdish Peshmerga fighters, their comrades in arms up here, filling in the spaces. But up in the area where I was today, these are population centers. Let me give you a picture here. As I came down from Duhok, I passed this interesting place called Demir. In this area where I am, all the cities are fairly rough concrete buildings, and the villages are all mud huts. Mm. And I come to this place, Demis, which is very new and very, very well put together. There's about 2,000 dwellings there, and this was built in the late 80s by Saddam Hussein as part of his campaign of Arabization, in which he transplanted many Arabs from the south up here to the Kurdish part of the country as a way of trying to neutralize Kurdish drives towards autonomy and independence. And in the last 48 hours, all 2,000 of those dwellings simply emptied out as people fled south towards Mosul. Going past Demis, we came past through several other areas. There was a large grain elevator, about 20 silos, Tom, and all around it there had been Iraqi soldiers camped, and there was a significant amount of fighting that had gone on there. Both, you could see the signs of airstrikes, but also, you know, much closer kinds of fighting. And then I got to the place called Jamur, where the Peshmerga had stopped last night. And I spent some time talking to the local commander. He and his officers were planning tonight's campaign, and you could tell they'd really been fighting. They had that kind of wide-eyed look of men who haven't slept for 48 hours and are surviving on living through combat and adrenaline.
So, Michael, do you perceive then that these American and Kurdish Peshmerga forces are driving toward Mosul, or are they just inching up around it and waiting for reinforcements of some kind?
The picture is beginning to become a little clearer up here in the north, Tom, because at the same time that I was getting closer to Mosul than I've been, a similar kind of slow moving towards the suburbs, I think is the best thing to describe it, was happening in Kirkuk as well. And you can see now that special forces and Peshmerga fighters are beginning to put themselves in place so that when the regime falls, and of course up here, I mean, everybody, if they're not out fighting, is glued to a television set watching any number of 24-hour news channels, either in English or in Arabic, and watching the pictures from Baghdad. I think basically there aren't enough forces to go in and seize these cities, and the Peshmerga will not be doing that. The U.S. is very clear about it. But they need to be in place to secure infrastructure in case, at the very end, you find that Saddam loyalists decide to start blowing up bridges or oil wells. They need to be in place to stop that. But they also need to just be there at the edge.
But overall, this is an exercise much more like what we saw in Afghanistan than in southern Iraq. A relatively quite few American troops and a lot of locals, in this case, Kurdish troops.
Yes, that's exactly what the picture is here. And, of course, never to forget the very effective use of calling in airstrikes. You don't need heavy artillery on the ground when you have a GPS system that can call in, you know, two phantom fighters that will bomb the position equally effectively as a tank. An interesting thing, Tom, was that at the most forward position I got to, which was an observation post staffed by both American Special Forces and Peshmerga fighters, I talked to one fellow and I asked him if in the fighting last night he noticed any difference in the way the Iraqi army was fighting back, because I thought that given the state of play in Baghdad, perhaps soldiers might be less enthusiastic for the fight. And he told me that the Iraqi army has no radios, so they have no idea what's going on down in Baghdad. And not only do they have no radios, there are death squads of Fedayeen Saddam standing behind them, prodding them forward. And so that's an interesting piece of information to pass on from the local Peshmerga here.
Michael Goldfarb, how do you imagine this might wrap up in the north? If Baghdad continues to be secured by U.S.-led forces, at some point they're going to want to look north, but there aren't enough U.S. troops there to do it. Turkey's very sensitive about the Kurds moving into these cities. Is there just a power vacuum? What's going to happen up there?
I think, Tom, that it's become clear to all of us, and it actually became clear about a week ago, that the strategy in the absence of a real northern front with a division of the American army coming through Turkey was simply to decapitate the regime in Baghdad and then hope that resistance would crumble away up here. And in fact, today, some of us were speculating, and it's just speculation, that if Saddam Hussein is indeed killed or effectively removed from power, would there be a senior Iraqi army officer who would then sign a surrender document calling on all Iraqi army forces to lay down their weapons, at which point we would all go to Mosul in that way, Mosul and Kirkuk. But it's pretty clear that the most important things are going to happen in Baghdad, and we'll just have to see how it really plays out up here.
A lot of speculation, even about a surrender that would leave it giving way without a fight. Michael Goldfarb, thanks for your report from the front there.
Thank you, Tom.
Michael Goldfarb is senior correspondent for WBUR's Inside Out documentary unit. He spoke with us earlier from Erbil in northern Iraq. Pouring across the Iraqi desert, the U.S. military may look like a uniformed fighting force, but beneath the fatigues and the flak jackets, behind the gun sights and inside the gun ships, U.S. forces include a markedly diverse slice of America, men and women, full-time and reserve, of every American color. But while the U.S. military pulls broadly from America, it is nothing like a true cross-section. The young soldiers battling in the Iraqi desert do not generally come from the country's very poorest tier, and they are certainly not from the affluent American elite. Over the past 30 years, the all-volunteer U.S. military has developed a distinctive middle American profile that some now call a warrior caste. More southern, more conservative, more technical school than college, a warrior caste where sons and daughters of soldiers often become soldiers themselves. The result, when politicians in Washington take the country to war, it's usually not their children or their neighbors that they're sending off to fight. Should America's military reflect America's whole population? Or are the fighting troops in Iraq doing just fine as they are, thank you? And are America's elites ducking military service? Would a different military profile mean a different U.S. foreign policy, and maybe less war? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Washington is Charles Moskos, professor of sociology at Northwestern University and author of The Postmodern Military, Armed Forces After the Cold War. He served in the U.S. Army Combat Engineers as a draftee from 1956 to 1958. Good evening and welcome, Charles Moskos.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's great having you. And with us from Durham, North Carolina, is Richard Cohn, professor and chairman of the Curriculum in Peace, War, and Defense at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's former chief historian for the U.S. Air Force and co-director of the Project on the Gap Between Military and Civilian Society at the Triangle Institute for Security Studies. Good evening and welcome, Richard Cohn.
Thanks for having me here.
Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
It's great to have all of you. We really are enthused to dive in and learn exactly who those soldiers are that we've seen so much of in the past few weeks in Iraq. Charles Moskos, let me turn to you first. We read widely that today's military is more diverse than ever. How has the profile of the U.S. Trooper, armed forces, changed over the past 30 years?
Well, since the end of the draft, there has been a major social change. I wouldn't call it the most diverse because you're not having, besides the top groups on our social ladder are not serving, you don't also, the bottom groups are not serving either. It's largely a working class and lower middle class military.
So you're correcting me in saying it's not the most diverse we've had. It would have been more diverse in World War II. Is that what you're suggesting? Or?
And during the Cold War draft as well, which is my era. The draft was equitable through World War II, then during the Cold War, and it became toward the end of the Vietnam War, basically excusing upper middle class kids again, and that's what ended the draft. But, for example, just take the Army enlisted ranks. The Army enlisted ranks today are now 45% minority. And actually, if you look at on the gender question, there are more black women in the Army than there are white women, even though blacks make up about 13-14% of the total population.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And other minorities, particularly Hispanics, have been growing in great numbers recently. But the class differences are probably most notable. These are largely high school graduates who are joining as a way up and out of what they might see as a dead-end existence otherwise. Jessica Lynch almost typified that. I think she's going to become the Sergeant York of this war.
The rescued POW.
The rescued POW, who apparently did some fighting before she was captured, though she's a maintenance a supply clerk.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a typical small town, not much opportunity, a way out to hopefully to get a college education as well. And I think that's very typical. And, of course, since they have been in Iraq, they have performed exceptionally well. But it's also, and the last remark I'd like to make is to remember that since the end of the Vietnam War, we have not suffered heavy casualties. Fewer than 600 people have been killed in action since the end of the Vietnam War, counting all of our military deployments.
And what does that say to you? How does that relate to the profile of the American soldier today?
Well, I think when you have this basically working class, lower middle class military, in which our elites don't serve, by the way, in the United States Congress, there are only 5 senators and representatives have children in the military today.
Mm-hmm.
Remember, all the Kennedy brothers served. None of the Kennedy cousins did. In my era, by the way, Elvis Presley was a fellow draftee.
Mm-hmm.
We never saw him, but we knew he was 90 kilometers down the road there in Germany. Just imagine if Eminem would join today.
So your big point is it really is the kind of technical school, working class, main ballast in the military today, and the affluent tier almost missing. Richard Cohn, we've just got a minute before the break, but at the top level, are there different attitudes, therefore, reflected in the U.S. military as well, as opposed to the population at large?
Well, we've compared the elite officers to kind of the American elite, and it's a more conservative and a more Republican a group of people. It's a little closer to a cross-section in attitude to the American people as a whole. I would say that the up-and-coming officers kind of fall in the middle between the American elite and the general American population.
We're going to come back and look at that in more detail, but Jack Beattie, I want to just turn to you before we go to the break. Charles Moskos is pointing to that missing elite, the missing top end of the financial tier, just not there.
They're not there, and you have to wonder, if they were there, would we have this foreign policy? Would we have this war? I know, Tom, that if we had a draft and my son were drafted, you and I would be vying to see who would go to the Capitol first to pitch a tent to prevent the war from happening. Neither of us did that because we didn't have dogs in this hunt, and I think that's the equity of the situation cries out for remedy, but also as a break on foreign adventurism, getting everybody involved would, I think, inevitably tend to do that.
We're going to come back and dig into who's really in this military, who's fighting America's wars and who's not, and ask whether we're creating a kind of hereditary and attitudinal warrior caste Blast, you can join the conversation tonight. Should America's military reflect America's whole population? And would a different military profile mean a different foreign policy? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're asking tonight, looking at who's fighting America's wars and who's not, and are we creating a new warrior caste in the U.S. military? You can join the conversation. Are America's elites ducking the call of duty? And what are the implications of that? Is it fair? Is it good? Is it right for the technical school tier of society to protect the liberal arts grads? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight, Richard Cohn, professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, former chief historian for the U.S. Air Force, and Charles Moskos, professor of sociology at Northwestern University and author of The Postmodern Military. Charles Moskos, is this all about Vietnam? Is this still the shakeout from the great resistance to that war and the draft that's changed the profile of the military today?
I think that's very much the case. It's good that you have, Richard Cohn here, too, because if you want to know about the officer class, which are, almost universally college graduates, mm-hmm. He's
97, 98, 99%.
Well, up there. My focus is more on the enlisted ranks. Here's one interesting sort of statistic. In my Princeton class of 1958, out of 750 males, 450 served in the military. The large majority of that is ROTC.
Mm-hmm.
Last year at Princeton, out of a class of 1,000 male and female now, only 3 were commissioned. So you can see from the...
We'll talk about a sea change.
Right, what a drop. The other interesting thing is about the elites not serving. Several people, colonels, have independently asked me, I wonder why the president... himself an Ivy League graduate, has not asked anybody to join the military since September 11th. And that's a sort of an interesting...
What about a very practical response to that? I mean, by all appearances at this point, the soldiers in Iraq are doing a heck of a job at war fighting, whether you favor the war or not. They seem to be getting it done in pretty brisk order. Does that suggest that whether this is a representative military or not, it's the right military?
It could well be if the wars are of this nature, as they has been since Vietnam, which are small-scale wars with casualties in the low hundreds rather than in the large thousands. I think when you don't have the elite fighting, a country will not accept casualties over the long haul unless the children of the privileged classes are also putting their lives on the line. But in these kinds of wars, this is an effective force. It's small, and it's, of course, obviously much more technical than in previous wars. And it's working. But I don't think it's going to work over the long run in case there's a major war. And with this kind of more inbred military, I think you're quicker to go in and quicker to get out if casualties really begin to mount.
Inbred military. I want to come back and look at that. But Richard Cohn, I hear you there. What's your big view here?
Well, I think Charlie has really, really nailed the one of the big differences, and that is that this is essentially a peacetime military, very similar to peacetime militaries in our past, an all-volunteer force in which the elites do not serve in the officer corps, although the officer corps matches the elite in some ways.
And in terms of college education, for example.
That's right. They have college educations. Mm-hmm. And, of course, before World War II, they were largely from the military academies and the Naval Academy. And then the enlisted folks are people who for various reasons want or need to get into the military. And in fact, our enlisted troops today are really quite a bit a cut above the people who served in the peacetime military up until 1940.
Why is that, Richard Cohn? Is the economy pushing people there because they don't have other options, or is this a real escalator up for people? What is it about the military
today?
Well,
I think it is an escalator up. It's people who either by tradition or desire want to serve. It may be in family tradition. They may want the technical training. By and large, they're the one-third of the young men who are not going to go to college or are not going to go to college right out of high school. And so they go into the military, learn a skill. They may end up going to college partly while they're in the military or afterwards on GI benefits. But in the past, the enlisted folks were often immigrants or people who were really down and out. And I think this is a stronger and more working class, middle class enlisted force than we've had historically. And they have been used for small wars in the past, beginning in the 20th century in the Caribbean, the Marines, the Army in the Philippines. And so it's much more like a traditional peacetime picture of the United States.
But for all that, Charles Moskos, I know that you, for one, are very uncomfortable with the military we've got today. You've called for a draft to be brought back. Why are you so uneasy with a military that, by its performance, seems to be working?
By its performance, it has been working. But as you know, Dick Cone just pointed out, these have been small wars. It won't, I think, suffice for a major war.
You're calling Iraq a small war?
Yes, that's a small war.
So a major war, I mean, we can hardly even comprehend a major war anymore, but you mean...
Well, Vietnam isn't that long ago, is it?
Okay, so
right.
You mean a long war with major casualties.
With tens of thousands of casualties.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea, too, with this current military is you're seeing two other interesting trends which haven't received as much attention as the end of the draft, and that is the use of civilian contractors to perform many tasks that were formerly done by uniformed servers. So you're contracting out. That's the ultimate marketplace, by the way.
Brown and Root and all that kind of auxiliary companies.
Building. As a matter of fact, in Kosovo, the first Americans to go there were Brown and Root before the troops arrived.
Charles Moskos, you write about what you call a warrior caste emerging here, which suggests a kind of hereditary involvement with the military, generation after generation. Is that what you're suggesting?
Well, I think we don't have solid data. But it appears that many of today's military are the children of the military. And, of course, since the end of the draft, that means they're coming from a narrow spectrum of the social ladder. We have another tendency, too, which is going to, I think, get more attention. You know, according to my analysis, about one-fifth of all the killed in action so far in Iraq were foreign-born. Many of them just green card people. Mm-hmm. So we're hiring more, in a sense, more foreigners who then view the military as an out option as well.
But you've been so critical, you've even gone as far as to say, if we're going to have a kind of specialized caste doing our military work, why not just hire foreigners? It brings back the image of the old Hessian soldier sent abroad by the British monarchy.
Well, that would be the logical conclusion of having a marketplace military. If you don't believe that citizenship responsibility should be shared by everyone, especially by those who most benefit from the society, why not just go to the Gurkha model, the Foreign Legion model, and be done with it?
Well,
and in a way, with our civilian contractors, we are doing that.
Richard Cohn?
If you have a constabulary that's kind of doing imperial policing, which is what some people think the United States is becoming, and its military fulfilling that function, well, then it will work that way. I mean, a much higher proportion of immigrants in the peacetime army before the Cold War and World War II. So I'm not as concerned as Charlie is about that, and I'm a little uncomfortable with the concept of caste. I don't think that's really accurate. It is a more separate society, and the military is becoming, I think, more isolated from society simply because it's smaller in a larger society and it exists on its bases and overseas.
Is there a danger of that in a democratic country to have a military that is kind of a group apart and, as you describe it, in the officer corps, more conservative, perhaps not entirely comfortable with some of the civilian, hubba bubba debate and, rough and tumble of debate of policy?
I think it can be dangerous if the civil-military relationship is one of tension and distrust and ignorance on the part of civilians and real mistrust on the part of the military. And I think we've been through that in the last 15 or 20 years, and hopefully we're coming back to a little more civil-military comedy. That is COMITY.
Yes.
And I think that there are always potential problems because the civil-military relationship is one of inherent friction.
And what about Jack Beatty's perspective that if the sons and daughters of the American elite, the more affluent, were more heavily represented in the military, the country would be less likely to go to war? Do you buy that?
I don't buy that because I think so many, many other factors are involved. If there's a big war and if it requires mobilization, the American people of all classes, ethnicities, races, answer the call. And if they don't answer the call, of course, we go to conscription, and then it works that way. But I think that There seems to be great public support for this kind of thing, and the people in the military want to be there. And if we did go to a draft, and I think maybe Charlie should address this, we would have so many people, and of course we would include women, that there would be really no way equitably to choose or distribute the burden. And not only would it be enormously costly, but it would not produce, I think, a fair distribution unless we used everybody.
Charles Muskos, you're the pro-draft guy tonight on a kind of a principled basis, but would it work?
I think it's win-win. That brings out a very good point. We have approximately 3.5 million youth, turning age 18 or thereabouts each year, mm-hmm. and you couldn't use that many people. But if you had a three-tier draft, the first principle is that the military is too small now, the active duty and the reserve forces. They're overstretched and undermanned.
An awful lot of reserve people pulled up out of their jobs for a long stretch here.
And once this war ends, you're going to watch reserve recruitment go into the toilet, too. This is going to be a real big problem. So by having a draft, you would obviously increase the size of the military, both reserve and active. But then there's the homeland security side, which, the big debate was whether the airport security people should be contractors from civilian organizations or whether they should be unionized federal civil servants. Obviously, they should be draftees. Nobody should do that kind of work for more than a year and a half anyway. Our ports are under. Nobody knows what's happening there. The Border Patrol, immigration.
So put them to work in homeland security roles.
Yeah. There were hundreds of thousands of tasks are needed there. And the third avenue would be, since we always had conscientious objection recognized in modern times, mm-hmm. civilian service. Teach for America, AmeriCorps. The President Bush has even proposed a Freedom Corps. So you would have those kinds of tasks as well.
Jack Beatty, what do you think?
Would not have enough, though, to go around to draft everybody, male and female. Mm-hmm. And
still not enough jobs with all that. So what would happen with the others? Or would it be a lottery? Not everyone would serve.
I would start at the top of the social ladder and work your way down.
Jack, you can hear Charles Muskos is just desperate to get the top of the social ladder engaged in military service or something close to it.
Well, if you look at charts of American incomes and prosperity in the post-war era, two lines sort of coincide. One is the line of basically all of us growing together in incomes. That is, while the top quintiles were doing well, the bottom were also doing well, and there was a kind of bulge in the middle. We grew together, and that was the era of the draft. Now, since the draft has stopped, almost exactly since it has stopped, we have grown apart. I'm not saying one is cause and effect. What I am saying is that there are two experiences in America increasingly. The experiences of those whose life has been benefited by the world, the global economy. And some people have said such people are close to secession from the nation. They can buy stuff from abroad. They have friends abroad. They incorporate their companies abroad. That's one experience. And on the other experience, we've had people who have just been, losing ground. Most American wage earners have been. Now, what happened in the old army was that people from different classes knew each other's life experiences. Now, I'm not saying that the president of Enron wouldn't have been such a predacious character if he had actually rubbed shoulders with ordinary people, but you have to wonder the way our capitalists treat their employees, how much of that is simply that they have never ever in their lives had to deal with ordinary people such that the experiences of ordinary people are something with which they have empathy.
Well, you're clearly describing a big change there, and I know many families can see it in my own kin in the Civil War and World War II and Korean War. Then I missed the draft in the Vietnam War, and since then, nobody, not engaged. Mike's calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Mike. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks, Mike.
I'm actually traveling through Erie. I'm from Indianapolis, Indiana.
Good to hear you.
I heard your comments about the elite, if their children were in the military and serving, that they wouldn't be in support, that they'd actually protest the war.
What do you think, Mike?
I'm actually appalled by that thought. I don't think you're giving the elite, if you want to label them as that, enough credit for their patriotism. I have three boys, and I'd be proud if any one of my three served in the military. Now, I'm not necessarily one of the elite in the country, but
We're defining elite pretty broadly here tonight, but just kind of getting toward, you know, a higher income, up out of the low middle.
Well, six digits.
Six digits begins to get there, I think, in this conversation.
I would be proud to have my boys serve. I served 8 years in the Marine Corps myself. I think every young man and woman in the right position in the military should serve. I don't think drafting them is a right choice. I believe choice is good, where, you know, if they decide they want to go in and get the training and serve their country, they should be commended for doing so. But to say that their parents would be out protesting or be against the war, you know, that would change their mind of the war, I don't agree with that comment at all.
You don't buy that, and we take it, Mike, but you can see, if you just look at the numbers, that in general, the more affluent Americans' children are not in the military. What do you make of that?
I guess I don't have an answer for that. Maybe the better opportunities on the outside world. You know, that's why I got out of the Marine Corps. I found a better job or a different career on the outside and can make more money, a better future for my family. But I am very happy for the time I spent in there. I got a lot of good training and was able to serve my country.
Mike, we've got it loud and clear, and we thank you for your call. Charles Moskos, what's your view on this front? Do you think it would change policy if we had broader participation, or policy would be fundamentally the same?
I think if you had that elite serving, and by the way, Mike, as a Marine, did serve, but we now, I think, are witnessing in America is what I would call patriotism light. Everybody says, oh, yes, we support the troops, but nobody's telling their children to join the armed forces, including the President of the United States. And you can't have it both ways and say that you support the troops if you don't want your own children in there. We also have a situation, too, where we have now with this volunteer force what I call overpaid recruits and underpaid sergeants. In the draft era, a senior sergeant made 7 times the income of a private. Today he barely makes 2.5 times the income of a private. And that's, and there's another factor, too, which nobody likes to talk about, which is that 1 out of 3 entrants in today's armed forces at the enlisted levels that fails to complete their enlistment term, their initial enlistment term. The dropout rate for draftees was 10%. Today it's 35%.
Mm-hmm. Richard Cohn, we just have a minute before the break here, but would you welcome draftees into this military? Is it the kind of military that can accept draftees anymore and make good use of them?
Well, it isn't configured for it, Tom, and I really think that the argument for the draft is basically what I'm hearing from Charlie and your other guest, is it's social engineering. I mean, Charlie has to look for jobs for these folks. I mean, it's peacetime. The people don't want to be coerced into military service.
But it's not peacetime tonight.
Well, it's not peacetime tonight because we're engaged in what's likely to be a pretty short war in the Middle East, and the United States military is committed all over the world. I know that, and we have a war on terrorism, but it doesn't look like or act like or feel like a war like any other war in American history.
Though we wonder if we're going to have those kind of wars anymore. We'll come back and talk about that. We're looking tonight at who's fighting America's wars and who's not, and whether or not it matters. Is it dangerous to democracy to have a warrior caste, more conservative, more southern, less affluent, outside the civilian mainstream? And members of the military, do you buy the picture of the military that we're hearing tonight? Do you see a warrior caste in the ranks? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about who's fighting America's wars and who's not, and whether or not it matters. Should America's military reflect America's whole population? Or does success in Iraq tell us that the military is doing just fine? Thank you. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can join the conversation. We're joined tonight by Charles Moskos, professor of sociology at Northwestern University and author of The Postmodern Military, and by Richard Cohn, joining us tonight from Durham, North Carolina. He's professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and former chief historian of the U.S. Air Force. You can join the conversation as well. John's calling from Quantico, Virginia. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
My concern is that it seems that your guests share a consensus that young people are joining the military because of economic pressure, or because they have to, or because that's their only route to move up. And in my experience, when I enlisted, and my experience with young folks in the service today, is that it's much more about getting a sense of purpose in their life and building on them as a person and a desire to serve their country than it is a desire to get technical training or some specific tangible benefit.
What service are you in, John?
I'm in the Marine Corps.
And so you don't see economic pressure as driving this, but rather a desire to step up. Richard Cohn, what do you know on this front?
Well, I don't have the statistics at my hand that Charlie does, but my suspicion is the Marine Corps, based on its tradition and its recruiting pitch, probably gets a larger percentage of those youngsters who are looking for the challenge, looking for the elan and the elite of the Marines, and serving for patriotic reasons. People don't join the military anyway for one reason alone. It's usually a combination of those things, and often it comes from a desire to serve and to be a part of something larger, as well as the skills and the pay and the upward mobility. But I'm not sure that the Marine Corps reflects quite the same mix of motives and attractions that some of the other services do.
Charles Moskos, what's your view? Congressman Charles Rangel has said this isn't really a volunteer military. People are joining because they need to economically. They're pressured that way. But our caller John says no, they're coming for direction in their lives. What do the numbers tell you?
They can both be true. It's interesting. The only person who was interested in my concept of a short enlistment option was a Marine Corps commandant who has to remain nameless. And when I was talking to him, I said, I'm surprised because the Marines have the fewest difficulties in recruiting because they have a special niche. And he made a very interesting observation, which is that he wants future leaders of America to be Marines. And that's what you're not going to get today. Future leaders are not going to be Marines or airmen or Navy or sailors or soldiers either, as we are finding in our Congress, for example. So now, and Dick quite aptly pointed out that there are, the typical enlistee has a variety of motives, and certainly define a sense of purpose is true, but nobody can deny the fact that your upper classes and your upper middle classes and your Ivy League graduates and people in at Duke and North Carolina and Northwestern are not joining the military. And that's the reality, and you can't hide yourself from that.
John, thanks for your call. Richard Cohn, I want to hear a bit more, if you'll share with us, about what you've seen in the evolution of attitudes and outlook of the officer tier. You describe them as more conservative than the country as a whole. Has that always been the case? What's the evolutionary trend here?
Well, I think it has always been the case that their cast of mind is more conservative, and often their views of social policy has been more conservative. But I think it's less diverse than it has been in the past, when we had the officer ranks leavened with a larger cross-section under the draft. It reflects, I think, the more peacetime, the more southern roots of it. And the big change that my colleague Peter Fever at Duke and I noticed in the last 25 years, at least on the subject of ideology, was a tendency to identify more in the officer corps with a political party. The percentage of nonpartisan officers has declined, and the officers now in the last generation and a half vote, and they see themselves more as an interest group in society. Of course,
and they vote Republican as opposed to what, an independent posture or in earlier years.
Well, that's right. I mean, the numbers of Republicans have jumped dramatically, and the numbers of independents or nonpartisans have dropped dramatically, and to the point where the officer corps is more identified as with a party than the elite as a whole or the American people as a whole.
What kind of implications do you think that might have for American policy, for American military use?
Well, I think it dovetails with a kind of an overhang from Vietnam. It's a more politically conscious officer corps. It's an officer corps that has more investment in certain kinds of political policies, foreign policies, more aware of it, and I think more likely to have friction with its civilian superiors. And I think, unfortunately, one that's more likely to be distrusted by the American people as just one more interest group. Some of our survey work showed that of course they are considered, you know, somewhat like a bureaucracy, and there's always been some distrust of the military. But in this case, to see them as kind of a self-interested kind of government elite, I think is not healthy for the civil-military relationship.
It doesn't sound good. David's calling from Boston. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I wanted to make a comment on what Jack Beatty had said, and I've heard a lot about this idea that somehow, because the military doesn't represent the elite, it actually people are more likely to go to war. I think quite the opposite is true, and I've seen this a lot in Cambridge where I work, that because elite people don't know anyone in the military, they're very callous about the military, and they don't. I think it makes it much easier to be against the war when you don't have a son or a daughter or a colleague or a brother going in. And in the military, you're very divorced from that kind of life.
So you feel an obligation not to do it because you're not directly in touch with it?
I think you're not in touch with it, and I think you're totally out of touch with the mindset that says that you would lay down your life for your country, because the defining moment of the American elite in the 1960s was the refusal to do that. You know, it was
laying down
out.
For peace. Mm. David, it's an interesting thought. Thanks for your call. Charlie Moskos, what do you make of that?
I think, well, David's got a point there, but there's an interesting historical fact that I think should be stressed here. In early 1944, the only way you could enter the military in World War II was through the draft. And you say, what? Yes, the Greatest Generation was joining in large numbers to get out of combat units, and they were flocking into the Army Air Corps and to some degree the Navy. They didn't want to go into the infantry, mm-hmm. so they did away with volunteers. So even the Greatest Generation was worried about how to stay alive, and I think that is a constant. And when you don't have these elite kids serving, the country is not going to take casualties. Even in World War II, we had some problems.
It's a fascinating subject, and I thank all of you, both of you, for sharing your view with us tonight. We're out of time, but it's been just terrific. Charles Moskos, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Charles Moskos is professor of sociology at Northwestern and author of The Postmodern Military. And Richard Cohn in Durham, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Thank you. A pleasure.
Richard Cohn is professor of history at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Jack Beatty, I know this gulf is there, and yet there are threads that reach across it. I have a much-loved niece whose boyfriend is a helicopter pilot in Afghanistan. She's on the telephone with him every day, and the reality of that conflict is much more real in her life and through hers mind because of that.
Yes, indeed it is. But let me just conclude with Hamilton in Federalist 8. He warned about the effects of war, and he warned about the effects of a standing army. He says, the perpetual menacings of danger oblige the government to be always prepared to repel it. The continued necessity for their services enhances the importance of the soldier and proportionately degrades the condition of the citizen. The military state becomes elevated above the civil. And he felt that was the danger of the standing army, especially in states that are attacked inside, as we have been.
Attacked inside, on the security front. You mean the terrorist
yes,
threat?
Yes.
Mm. Words from Hamilton. Jack Beatty, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, reflections from a mother of an Ivy League soldier. This is On Point. Regina Herzlinger is one of an increasingly rare breed. The Harvard Business School professor is the mother of an Ivy League student who opted to join the military. There was a time when many students from America's top schools would trade their caps and gowns for fatigues and helmets, but not these days. Harvard, Herzlinger's son's alma mater, doesn't even have an ROTC program anymore. In this radio diary, Regina Herzlinger laments the lack of Ivy League representation in the U.S. military.
Was a typical Cambridge, Massachusetts dinner party. The academic professional guests were seated on damask upholstered chairs perched on vividly colored antique rugs. Their charming, well-groomed images reflected in sparkling Chinese Chippendale framed mirrors. They were on to a favorite topic, stupidity of W. Rumsfeld and the war. One, a chef, was especially virulent. The war won't accomplish anything. It's all about money. The Bushes are in bed with the oil industry. We are fighting to protect their interests. Do not get me wrong. This is not a tirade against the People's Republic of Cambridge. I've heard identical remarks about Bill Clinton, William Cohn, then Secretary of Defense, and the military forays they waged. Only the setting differed. The speakers were businessmen, and the ornate furnishings decidedly new, but the sentiments were identical. The president and the secretaries of defense were dumb. Their words were stupid. Geez, I wish I were so stupid. Maybe my friends have the cunning, intellect, charm, stamina, and emotional and physical discipline needed to become the president of this huge, fractious nation. I sure don't. My husband broke into the conversation. "This is not an academic discussion for us," he said. Unlike most of his Harvard College 2000 classmates, our son Alex chose to serve his country as a first lieutenant in the U.S. infantry. Stationed at Fort Drum, New York, he has just received deployment orders. It was as if my husband had switched on a flow of electricity. The tenor of the conversation changed entirely. "I don't know anyone with a child in the military," said the chef. The other guests nodded in agreement. "How do you feel about it?" he asked me. "I was shocked when Alex told me of his decision to enroll in ROTC," I said. "Why don't you enlist when a noble war like World War II comes along?" I asked Alex. "The ROTC way, you will serve at the whim of the president, no matter how distasteful you find the war." My then 18-year-old son calmly disagreed with me. "We need a standing military to preserve democracy," he noted. "The military must serve the will of the country, not its own." With this human face put on the war, the chef's attitude changed. "Ask Alex if he wants me to cook him a meal when he comes home," he said. Alex's choice of ROTC at Harvard imposed substantial burdens on him. Harvard has no ROTC on campus. The faculty voted to ban it in 1969. On top of his academic work and beloved football team, Alex spent 10 hours a week at MIT's ROTC headquarters. His two burly roommates, football team buddies, recognized his load when they graciously gave him the only bedroom in their Leverett House quarters. Their show of support was hardly unanimous. I was among the few Harvard faculty present at Alex's ROTC graduation ceremony. In 1957, 400 of 750 Princeton men served in the military. Last year, it was 3 in a class of 1,000. The statistics are depressingly similar in other Ivy League schools. Virtually all our friends noted them. When they called to ask about Alex's welfare, they said, "We don't know anybody else with a child in the military." One of the many horrors of the war in Vietnam was the inequity in our fighting forces, disproportionately drawn from minority groups and those with lower levels of education. Despite the vows to correct the problem, the widespread disdain in our elite academic institutions for the military has only exacerbated it. Absent broad participation from all strata in our society, the military and the wars our soldiers fight can remain a fantasy, virulently and easily decried. But as Lincoln noted, in yet another widely decried war fought predominantly by the lower classes, a house divided against itself cannot stand.
Regina Herzlinger is a professor at Harvard Business School. She lives in Belmont, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.